This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Phyllis Bennis joins us from Washington, D.C. to talk about how we return to the, quote, new normal when the pandemic dies down.
The old normal was terrible. This is not a pendulum that's going to swing back. Everything's going to be different, and that's what we want to talk about.
Our friends at the People's Law Office in Chicago are celebrating a victory in the Greensboro case where cops hogtied and killed a civilian.
They won a major motion on this case. The case is going to proceed now. And Greensboro has a long history of police abuse and police murder.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Good morning, Michael. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, we're broadcasting remotely. Heidi, you're in Manhattan. I'm up in the Catskill Mountains, and our wonderful producer, Jeff Brady, is manning the controls.
Yes. I wanted to start off, Michael, on a very sad note. As you know, one of the people who has been a steadfast supporter of our radio show, Perry Rosenstein, passed away from the virus.
Perry was the founder and the president of the Puffin Foundation, and they were a principal supporter and were and are of Law and Disorder. I remember meeting with him and his wife, Gladys Miller Rosenstein, and their son, Neil Rosenstein, out at the Puffin Foundation headquarters in Teaneck, New Jersey, years ago. He was very supportive of the kind of independent journalism that the three of us are doing. Perry was an immigrant Polish-Jewish person, came from an immigrant family, grew up in the Bronx, and served in World War II. When he got out, he had a GI Bill scholarship to college, and when he finished college, he organized a company that manufactured fasteners, screws and fasteners, something we don't know much about, but it became the major company in the world. And in 1983, after he sold the company, he set up the Puffin Foundation to support independent journalism, to support artists, particularly Black and Latino artists, women artists, people that were traditionally overlooked in support from the art community. He went on to set up a foundation to preserve the Teaneck watershed in New Jersey, and they named the Puffin Foundation after a bird on the coast of Maine that was about to go extinct. And so that became kind of the metaphor for Perry's work. He also organized the annual Puffin Foundation award. It was a prize for creative citizenship. Every year they give out $100,000, and Michael Ratner was a recipient of it. So was Amy Goodman. He set up a gallery at the Museum of the City of New York to portray social movements. It's an amazing place. We did a show with the director of the gallery. So Perry Rosenstein was a giant. We will sadly miss his leadership, and we're grateful for his continuing support.
We are. He was also the creator, Michael, of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, which preserved the history of Americans who fought against Franco and fascism.
Yes, I remember when Michael Ratner was invited to speak at their annual event. He was just this extraordinary person. Heidi, you and I and Jeff pledged to honor his memory by keeping Law and Disorder going.
Definitely. Michael, there's so much in the news related to the virus right now. And we are fortunate to be able to have our homes to stay sheltered in place. But I wanted to talk about the sailors on board the aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt. You know that a few weeks ago, the captain, Brett Crozier, was removed from his command after acting in behalf of his nearly 5,000 sailors. He wrote a letter of concern asking leadership to offload most of the sailors so that they could sanitize the ship and allow for social distancing. And as our listeners know, the letter was leaked to the San Francisco Chronicle. Crozier was fired, and Naval Operations is actually conducting an investigation into his actions. But what was really scandalous was that after that, Acting Navy Secretary Thomas Maudley, a civilian, flew to Guam and addressed the crew of the Teddy Roosevelt over their ship's internal loudspeaker, using profanity, calling Crozier stupid and otherwise deriding him. And I just read that Maudley's trip not only cost him his job, we know he resigned after that, but it cost taxpayers nearly $250,000 in terms of the jet that was used to fly him there. I find that an abomination.
Yeah, it's obscene. They should take that money out of his retirement account.
Exactly. And Crozier was doing what any responsible citizen should do, namely calling out impossible conditions. Now, at least 230 sailors on board the aircraft carrier have tested positive, as is Crozier right now. What does this say, Michael, about our leadership?
Yeah, he called Maladi called Crozier not only stupid but naive. I was glad to see that there was such a outcry that he got fired. I saw a video of the troops, sailors on the ship, jeering him and chanting against him. It reminded me of the beginning of the Russian Revolution. The sailors did the same thing on the battleship Potemkin, and I thought, well, this may be our Potemkin moment here. And then I contrasted that with Ed the Blade Garrity. Let me just talk about him for a second, because he was a Navy SEAL. Demotion was prevented by Trump. The Blade Garrity stabbed and killed a captured soldier, a young woman, with his own knife. And his troops are so appalled by the guy that they turned him in, which was a rare occasion. And he was demoted. And when Trump was made aware of this by the right wing, Trump, in an effort to curry favor with the right wing, then undemoted him in the Navy SEAL. And when the head of the Navy, the Secretary of the Navy, protested against what Trump did, Trump fired him. So now the wheel has come full circle, hasn't it?
Yes. The good news in terms of people activism is that at the time we recorded this, more than 60,000 individuals have signed a change.org petition calling for the reinstatement of Crozier. Now, one final note on this is that when Maudley was addressing the crew, he took the opportunity to criticize China and its role in the pandemic. He said, the only reason we're dealing with this right now is because a big authoritarian regime called China was not forthcoming about what was happening with this virus. And they put the world at risk to protect themselves and to protect their reputations. I think this is an example of how many of our leaders right now, unfortunately, are mixing politics with public health. And I don't think there's a place for that if we're going to really change the way we deal with pandemics.
Now, it's a racist attempt to divert people's attention. Instead of addressing the crisis immediately, which Trump refused to do, and instead of having a health care system that had adequate protections for us, instead they're saying this is the fault of the Chinese people. Heidi, we want to remind our audience of two things. One is, if you want to be on our mailing list, go to lawanddisorder.org and click the appropriate button. We'll be able to reach out to you and keep you up to date on what we're doing here at Law and Disorder. And secondly, we wanted to announce that Governor Cuomo has yet to do anything about releasing prisoners who are in a wildfire situation about getting the COVID virus, particularly aged prisoners. And I'm thinking especially of my friend David Gilbert. You can call Governor Cuomo and give him your opinion on the situation at 518-474-8390. Let me repeat, Governor Cuomo can be reached at 518-474-8390. Call him and tell him to release these prisoners before they die in their prisons. We are into a new economic and political period. The economic crisis has been looming and was predicted, but the COVID-19 pandemic triggered it. There will be no going back to, quote, normal. Arundhati Roy has written that historically pandemics have forced humans to break with the past and imagine the world anew. This one is no different. It is a portal, a gateway between one world and the next. As Reverend William Barber recently wrote, this virus is teaching us that from now on, living wages, guaranteed health care for all, and unemployment and labor rights are not far-left issues, but issues of right versus wrong and life versus death. That there will be changes when the crisis has passed is a certainty. The pendulum will not swing back to what was called normal. What is uncertain is what kind of changes will take place, and will they be done to us or by us and for us? We speak today with returning guest Phyllis Bennis of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, where she is the director of the New Internationalism Project. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Michael.
Let's talk about the crises that we were in prior to the pandemic. Half the country then was poor or near poor. Real wages hadn't gone up in 40 years. Three American families were worth more than the combined wealth of the entire bottom half of our population. Millions of people had no health insurance or inadequate and expensive insurance. Since 9/11, the surveillance and national security state had grown immensely. The U.S. war machine was active in a number of countries and had 800 bases in over 100 countries around the planet. Nuclear war was an increasing probability, and human-caused climate change was bringing us closer to catastrophe. So what I'd like to speak with you about today is what kind of positive changes do you say we should be advocating for the post-COVID-19 era? You know, for example, Spain is thinking of passing a law that guarantees a living wage for everybody. So what kind of positive changes do you think we can make given the terrible situation we were in even before the pandemic?
Yeah, this is so important. I think it is key for all of us who are organizers, who are writing, talking about this stuff, that first we do keep in mind just how horrific this particular pandemic is. People's lives are being destroyed in all kinds of ways. The most direct, the thousands of people who are ill, thousands now have died and more will die, and they're dying alone in hospitals that aren't equipped to allow even their families to be with them. So we have to be really careful not to sort of only look to the future. We do have to look to the future, though. And I think the first thing we have to say is that the goal here, the first goal is to deal with the health issues. The second goal is to be sure that when we're out of this, when we're done with this, when we're past this, that we don't go back to what used to be normal, because there was nothing normal about it. It was a crisis. It was a series of crises. It was a climate crisis. It was a war crisis. It was an immigration crisis. It was a crisis in all of these ways. It was a poverty crisis. And it was a racism crisis and a misogyny crisis. All of these things were in crisis. So the goal should not be to get back to where we were. The goal should be to say, how do we come out of this better and stronger and healthier for everybody? So I think there are some specific things that are underway, similar to what's being discussed in Spain and a number of other countries. In the U.S., like in Kentucky, there's been an announcement that there will be no evictions through the course of the corona crisis. In, I think it's Illinois, there was a decision that there will be no water shutoffs. And the struggle now is to move that further and say not only should there be no more water shutoffs, but any water systems that were shut off have to be reopened. So there are some of those immediate campaigns going on. I think that the demand for increasing direct funding, the millions of people now who have lost their jobs with no potential of getting new jobs anytime soon. There's going to be much more money needed for that. But again, there, we have to be very certain that we include the people who were excluded quite deliberately from the assistance in, for example, the third assistance bill that was passed, last week, I guess. There was a lot of good stuff in that bill that was fought for by important social movements, movements around unemployment, the labor movement, all of that. They fought hard and they won some important concessions. But they're not enough. Prisoners were not included there. There's no protection for prisoners. Undocumented people were explicitly excluded from it. And fundamentally, the poorest people, people who don't even earn enough money to have to pay federal taxes, for instance, won't even get the very minimal $1,200 check because they didn't file taxes last year and almost certainly won't this year because they don't have access to it. They don't know they have to. They don't know how. They don't have the forms. Often they don't speak English. These are the most vulnerable communities. And what we should be focusing on now is to make sure that, one, we get more federal support, more money to hospitals, more money to people and to communities, and to make sure that those definitions are expanded so that everybody is included.
What about the health industry? Do you think that this crisis has shown that the health industry, it's not a good idea to run it on the basis of private profit, and that the health industry should be publicly owned?
Well, clearly, as you say, healthcare is a right. It's not a privilege, and it's not a commodity. The problem with our healthcare system is that its goal, as you say, the goal is to make profit for the healthcare industry, for the health insurance agencies, for the giant hospital corporations. Only secondarily is the goal of health of people the goal of the healthcare industry. So, yeah, it needs transformation. It needs absolute transformation. There needs to be a single-payer system. Whether that's the immediate demand right now, I don't know. Whether Medicare for all is the right demand right now is a tactical question. But what's not tactical at all, what's the basis of principle, is that healthcare is a right, and that people who are making millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, because they are obligated, you know, that's the irony, Michael, when we look at, like, what are the corporate laws. When you look at these giant insurance corporations, for instance, their product is health insurance, right? And we can look at them and say, it's an outrage that they charge this kind of money for policies that cover so little, that make it impossible for someone to actually keep up their preventive health, to go to a doctor when they're sick, without having to pay huge amounts of money, even though they officially have health insurance. But part of the problem is that these are massive corporations who have a fiduciary duty to do one thing, and an audience of account that they're accountable to that is the only one, and that is their shareholders. Their obligation as these giant corporations is to make money for their shareholders. Everything else is secondary. That's what has to be changed. It has to come out of the so-called private sector, whatever we want to call it, and be controlled by people, where there's accountability to people's lives and not to shareholder money and CEO salaries, we should note.
Yeah, really, which are salaries which are just enormous. What about the climate crisis? We had Doug Henwood, the economist, on Law and Disorder last week, and he was advocating for the nationalization of banks and then using them to fund a Green New Deal. Does that make sense to you?
In the long term, absolutely. I think there's a short-term related fix that could go a very long way towards a Green New Deal. Colleagues of mine at the Institute for Policy Studies, Sarah Anderson and others at IPS, have been working for many years on the notion of a financial transaction tax, which isn't a tax on the banks. It's a tiny tax. It's usually considered something like 0.1%. So an incredibly tiny tax on things like stock trades, which go on in enormous numbers because they're all computer-generated these days. And that tiny tax on those financial transactions would earn hundreds of billions of dollars that could be put directly into healthcare. So I think that sort of thing is absolutely appropriate when we're looking at other parts of the economic system. But the biggest thing we could do in terms of climate, as with healthcare, is to cut the military budget. The military now is using 53 cents of every discretionary federal dollar, 53 cents, that's going directly to the military. And that's not even including stuff like veterans care and all the other kind of related things, but just the military itself. And as long as that's going on, that distortion of our economy, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King taught us that the morality of a country shows in its budget. Well, our budget is pretty damn clear that our priority is the military and not people's lives. We could cut the military budget in half. Another colleague of mine, Lindsay Koshgarian, did a terrific piece that was in the New York Times op-ed page a few months ago. Unusual for us to get into the New York Times, but there it was. It's a brilliant piece that she did, looking at how we could cut $350 billion out of the military budget. That's just a little under half, and still be safe, still be able to do all of the things that are legitimate and, frankly, some things that are not so legitimate. But by cutting this massive bloated military budget in half, we would suddenly free up enough money to get a good head start on Medicare for All and a Green New Deal and a jobs program and. It's not enough to cover all of them, but it's enough for a good head start on all of them. And that's the kind of big thinking that we need to be doing right now, while we keep in mind the urgency of now, the urgency to get money now to hospitals, to get the equipment to hospitals, to get ventilators to hospitals, to get personnel to hospitals, to protect our personnel. All of that is the urgency of now. The urgency of tomorrow is how do we come through this more powerfully than ever.
You know, you wrote a piece recently for Newsweek that was an eye-opener for me. You, along with Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, addressed the fact that the military controls a huge resource of medical supplies, medical resources. You had suggestions about what we could do with that, and that was countered by a Lieutenant General, Mark Hertling, on CNN, who said that that would be impractical. I wanted you to talk about that, because that was really an amazing revelation, that the military has all these supplies and we should have our hands on them, not the military.
Yeah, you know, it's something that we don't think about that often, but it goes right back to what I said a minute ago about the military budget. That budget is being used to buy stuff and pay people, right? That's what it does. Now, a huge amount of it, almost half, goes directly to military contractors, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, all the big ones, to build submarines and nuclear weapons and bombs and guns and drones and bombers and all those things, a huge amount of it. And what's also true is that the military has over 2 million people in it. It has an enormous, incredibly sophisticated healthcare and medical system, through which it keeps those soldiers healthy. Now, keeping soldiers healthy is a good thing. I certainly support our soldiers having access to good health care. However, all of that is paid for by U.S. tax money. All of it is something that should be accountable, not to the military brass itself to decide how much they may grudgingly want to dole out to you people out there, to take it away from the most important thing. You know, they said directly, Hertling said this and others have said it, the most important goal of the military is the protection of our troops. And you want to look at what happened in that aircraft carrier in Guam and see how true that is or isn't. I would say it certainly is not. But rhetorically, that's the justification for keeping the military's hands tightly controlling the whole network of 50 military hospitals across this country, not to mention in many more across the world. The smaller scale clinics and emergency rooms that exist on almost every military base across this country, the thousands of doctors, surgeons, nurses, technicians, tens of thousands of ventilators, huge stockpiles of medical equipment that are under the control of the military that are completely separate from the so-called U.S. national stockpile of this stuff. So what we have is, with great fanfare, we had the announcement, for example, that the military was going to dole out, I think it was 50,000 gown and glove sets, some 10,000 ventilators. I'm not sure I have the numbers right, but some very specific amounts. But why was that left in the hands of the military to decide how many should be shifted from control of the military to the general national stockpile, where it's controlled by people, by the government, by people who are accountable to voters? It's that question of accountability. Who gets to decide? The claim was made, well, we have to keep the troops safe because they're protecting us in this time of crisis. Well, I'm sorry, but I don't think that a bunch of ground troops are doing much to protect us from the coronavirus, right? It doesn't work that way. We get to decide what the threat is that's facing the United States people, and we should be the ones to decide what materials owned by the government get accessed by people versus accessed only by the military brass themselves. So I think it's a very complicated thing. It's not something that we usually talk about, as you say, that, you know, we should be taking over military decision-making. There was a kind of awful statement from one of the generals who said something like, you know, it's impractical for us to be, you know, giving too much of these resources away, but instead the military should be used to assist with command and control. It's like, no, that's exactly the opposite of what we need. That's what we don't need. We don't need the military to take over control of this coronavirus response. We do need the military's doctors and their stockpiles. We need their hospital ships, which were grudgingly, after weeks, sent to Los Angeles and New York, but they are still not taking corona patients. You know, so it's this sense of the military being privileged above the people of this country that is a really serious problem that I think we really have to stop.
Yeah, that general said that the commanders and their staffs practice managing information and deliberations regarding crisis decision making. That's definitely, I couldn't believe when he said that. That's the kind of military dictatorship that's so scary. But, you know, Eisenhower, when he left office, his last speech really nailed it. Eisenhower said that we have a military-industrial complex, and that's our main worry, that they're taking our resources. How do you, and people at the Institute for Policy Studies, how do you figure we take on a vested interest that gigantic and powerful?
We take it on the way we've taken on vested interests forever, social movements that mobilize against it. You know, Michael, if you look back at the history of this country, this is something I've always so appreciated from the great historian Howard Zinn, who taught us that we have to recognize that the origins of this country are grounded in what made this country powerful and wealthy. Those things are grounded in slavery and genocide. Genocide against the indigenous population of this land, slavery of enslaved Africans who were brought here in chains. But he also went on to say, but the history of our country is also the history of the movements against genocide and slavery and all of the evils that have come since. So that's the legacy on which we stand. That's what we have to be focusing on right now, building the kinds of movements that will challenge not just the immediate, certainly the immediate, because that's the urgency of now, but that will also challenge the urgency of next week and the urgency of the 140 million people in this country who are poor or so low wealth that they are one paycheck away from catastrophe, that they don't have enough money to deal with a $400 emergency, something that others of us would take for granted as being possible. Almost half of our country cannot do that. Those are the urgencies. Those are the immediate crises that we have to be building movements both to represent and to fight for. And I think when we look at this question of challenging the military-industrial complex, it means making those links so that everybody who's fighting for the fight for 15, everybody who's fighting against poverty, everybody who's fighting against racism, everybody who's fighting for immigrant rights, for LGBT rights, for Medicare for All, for the Green New Deal, all of these movements, we need to be getting them the information so that they can, in the context of their work, not as a separate thing, not as some box you check off somewhere, but in the context of their work, making clear that the way you pay for it, because remember, that's always the question, well, Green New Deal sounds pretty good, but how are you going to pay for it, right? The answer is cut the military budget. That's the starting point for all of it, because that's the biggest chunk of what distorts the morality of the the budget and the economy of this country and of this government. So that's how we start. We build social movements to challenge the military complex, the military-industrial complex, the way we've always had movements to challenge the evils of this country and every country before us.
The nuclear crisis is even more threatening now than it was just several years ago. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved their doomsday clock hand up to almost midnight. Treaties have been canceled. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been appropriated to build a new nuclear arsenal. Talk about that, please, and what we can do about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The nuclear weapons crisis, the threat of an actual nuclear exchange, is higher than ever. The Trump administration, with the lashing out of its policies around Iran, the cancellation of the Iran nuclear deal, were all about canceling anything that the Obama administration had accomplished and building up the kind of Islamophobia at home and anti-Iran mobilization abroad that has been a hallmark, a key hallmark of the Trump administration's policies from the beginning. Without paying any attention, nobody's paying attention, it seems, in the White House, and not enough attention elsewhere, about the normalization of nuclear threats that's underway here. When the U.S. pulls out of the last existing nuclear treaty with Russia, that's making a direct threat to Russia, another nuclear weapons state, about the use of nuclear weapons as something normal. The idea that we are now spending, the plan is to spend, oh, if I have the figures right, it's, I think, $1 trillion over the next 10 years in upgrading and modernizing and miniaturizing the nuclear arsenal so that it will, again, normalize the possible use of nuclear weapons. We're sending nuclear weapons around the world in the form of nuclear-powered submarines and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, and somehow that's not seen as violating the nuclear weapons-free zones that have been established with great struggle from social movements in many parts of the world. And when we see the kinds of conflicts that erupt between the United States and Russia, between the U.S. and China, You see the real danger that any of these conflicts that so far, luckily, have been kept to a minimum, at any moment, one of those could explode by mistake as well as by decision and escalate too quickly to stop it to what could emerge as a nuclear exchange. So we're in a very, very dangerous moment where there's simply so much that people need to be responding to that's so urgent in people's lives directly, the lives of the poorest sectors of our communities, undocumented people who are facing an enormous crisis, people in prisons and in detention in the midst of this corona crisis that are facing life and death struggles because of the conditions in which they're forced to live. There are so many urgent issues that things that seem a bit more distant, like nuclear weapons, somehow get less attention, and it's understandable why, but it's up to those of us who have access to that material to make it more easily accessible, to make it more connected to other kinds of movements.
Phyllis Bennis, Bernie Sanders, who both of us supported, suspended his campaign, and his campaign was so encouraging to us because it was linking the various movements you've been talking about. So my question is, what do we do now? Can we accomplish what Bernie was trying to accomplish through the Democratic Party?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just clarify. I work for a nonprofit organization, and we don't officially endorse candidates. What I certainly did support and continue to support is the notion that the Sanders campaign put forward, others have in the past, that, well, the slogan was, it's not about me, it's about us. And the idea was that this is a movement. This is not just a campaign. And I think that what happens now is we remember that and recognize that who runs for office is not in our control, in fact. I don't believe in this country. I think that our election system is damaged enough that it's not really the turf of people. It's not our turf. We're not fighting on our turf. We're fighting on somebody else's turf. But when we have the opportunity to build movements that engage with power through electoral processes, that's a hugely important thing that we cannot give up. So I think what happens now is the movement side of the Bernie campaign was key. I mean, if we go back in history to the 1980s, Michael, you and I are both old enough to remember Jesse Jackson's two campaigns in 1984 and 1988.
Phyllis, I remember Eisenhower's campaign.
Okay, you beat me. But I remember Jesse Jackson's campaigns. I also remember earlier ones, I confess. But what was different about Jackson's campaigns was that Reverend Jackson understood, as well as Bernie Sanders understood, that this is about building movements. The Rainbow Coalition that emerged out of those campaigns that included so many communities. It included the Black community and Latino community. It included an Arab stripe of the rainbow for the first time. It included an LGBT stripe of the rainbow. And, you know, in all those ways, it brought together a whole host of movements that had been relatively separated for a long time. The anti-war movement was in there. Everybody worked on those campaigns together. And it wasn't about, we're going to elect this guy. I think most of us never thought that was going to happen. Maybe some people thought it would. I never did, and most people I worked with didn't. But we recognized it as an opportunity to build movements that were not just about who ultimately gets chosen. It is about engaging with power. We can't leave that aside. These are hugely important decisions about who gets appointed to the Supreme Court. You know, all of those things matter. They matter to people's lives. But what matters in the long run is building movements that fight for the principles of those campaigns, whether it's Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, free college education, all these things that have become mainstream issues. We have to fight now, as we've been fighting all along. People fought in the Elizabeth Warren campaign and in other local campaigns, congressional and Senate campaigns, to make sure that these are now normalized demands that should be making it into the mainstream of the parties. You know, the Democratic Party platform should be reflecting what were the key demands of such a large component of the Democratic Party base, as seen in these primaries. That includes the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and free college education and a $15 minimum wage, all of those things. And we're close to that now. If we look at what our movements have accomplished, it's not because we had the perfect candidate. It's because movements were demanding these things and working together to say these are normal things that we should be focusing on right now, and we should be fighting for them in the context of the Sanders campaign or any other campaign, and in the context of the elections and outside the elections. We're fighting for principles. We're fighting for issues. We're fighting for equality. We're fighting against poverty. We're fighting against war. We're fighting against racism. All of these things. We're fighting for science, for God's sakes. We never thought we'd have to fight for science, but we do. So those are the things that I think have to continue now.
Phyllis Bennis, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately. But before I have to let you go, can you tell us how we can learn more about your work at the Institute for Policy Studies and the New Internationalism Project as well?
Sure. The New Internationalism Project, which is my colleague Karee Peterson-Smith and myself, we work on issues around war and militarism, around how wars create the challenges around migration and the militarization of borders. We work on a whole range of those kinds of foreign policy issues around Palestinian rights and a whole host of related issues. The Institute, which has been around now for 57 years, works to change ideas into action for peace, justice, and the environment. That's kind of our tagline. And we work with social movements. We also work some we engage with power directly. We have good ties with the Progressive Caucus of Congress and the Black Caucus and the Latino and Native caucuses of the Congress. But most of our work is with social movements, helping to create strategic approaches and analysis that can help these powerful social movements turn their ideas and mobilizations into real action, and that can move towards real change in policy. And the people can find us online. We're working, of course, at home these days, all of us. We've been lucky our staff was able to move without too much problem to everybody working at home and meeting online. But our website is still pretty vibrant, which is ips-dc.org. Our social media presence is still pretty strong out there, IPSDC. So I urge people to take a look and stay in touch with us.
Phyllis, thank you very much. We've been talking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. Good to be able to speak with you in these dire times, Phyllis. You take it easy and you be safe.
Thanks, Michael. The same to you and to everybody on your team there. Many thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
On March 25th, North Carolina federal judge Loretta Biggs allowed a civil rights lawsuit over the hog tying of Marcus Dion Smith to move forward. Smith, a young black man, was killed by 8 Greensboro police officers and several emergency medical technicians during the 2018 North Carolina Folk Festival. Hog tying is when a person's hands and feet are tied behind their backs. Smith's hog tying was ruled a homicide by the state medical examiner. The Smith family is being represented by North Carolina attorney Graham Holt and Ben Elson and Flint Taylor of the PLO, the People's Law Office in Chicago. "This is an outstanding and long-awaited victory for the Smith family," said Taylor. "It recognizes that the use of brutal hog tying of defenseless persons is a clear violation of their constitutional rights, and that the Greensboro Police Department was woefully and inadequately trained in using restraints which were a direct cause of Marcus's death." Marcus's mother, Mary Smith, thanked the judge for allowing the case to go forward. His father said in tears that he will forever be haunted by seeing his son taking his last breath on the street pavement. We're joined today by attorney Flint Taylor, one of the premier police abuse lawyers in the country. Attorney Taylor is the author of the recently published book, The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. I'm really happy to be with you.
Flint, what happened to Marcus Dion Smith?
Well, Marcus Dion Smith was a homeless man who had mental issues. He was most likely on some kind of drugs at the time. It was at 12:30 at night in the folk festival down there in Greensboro, and he was like wandering back and forth on the street. The police came up on him, the Greensboro police, and he was begging to go to the hospital. He understood he was having problems. The police talked to him for a while. They then got him into their squad car, ostensibly to take him to the hospital. He started to thrash around a bit, hit the window because he was getting claustrophobic, being in the squad car, and the squad car wasn't taking him anywhere. So the officers there then grabbed him out of the squad car under the pretext that he was kicking a window, and dragged him out onto the ground. And then within seconds, there were 8 white Greensboro police officers surrounding him. Within seconds, they decided they were going to restrain him with what's called a rip hobble. And a rip hobble is a restraint device which you can basically hog tie someone. And that's what they did. They bound his hands and his legs and put them together, tightened behind his back, in a prone position with his chest on the ground. They tightened it so that his legs and arms were well beyond a 90-degree angle. And within 30 or 40 seconds, he was asphyxiated. He died. There was a paramedic, 2 of them who were there from the county. Their contribution to this was to say when they arrived, is he black, before they saw him. They did nothing, and both at the time that he was hogtied or for a minute or 2 or 3 afterwards when he was losing and lost consciousness and was losing breath. And perhaps they had a chance to bring him back, but they did nothing but load him into a wagon a few minutes later, and he was gone. They then initiated a cover-up, Mike. They mentioned his death publicly, the chief did, but they never said that he was restrained, hogtied, or anything like that. They just said he'd passed away and wasn't known until the lawyer, Graham Holt, and the father, George Smith, went to see the body camera, see the footage from the body cameras, and then, to his horror, Mr. Smith saw that his son had been violently hogtied and killed in that manner. That's what happened to Marcus. He was a beloved figure in the homeless community. He was a barber. A lot of people loved him. His parents and his sister were very supportive of him, and they, along with the Greensboro community, both the homeless community and the African-American community, has been up in arms about this case ever since. It happened in September of 2018, so it's going on a year and a half now since the homicide of Marcus Dion Smith happened.
Attorney Flint Taylor, what constitutional rights is his family and you, on behalf of the family, what are you alleging were violated?
Well, we waited for a while because they talked down there about possibly doing an independent investigation, but nothing came of that. The mayor waffled on it. At one point, she condemned the police superintendent or the police chief for his cover-up. At another time, she was very ambivalent about doing anything about it. City council was divided about whether to do anything about this killing. And so in April of last year, we brought a Section 1983 lawsuit. Myself, Ben Elson of the People's Law Office, Graham Holt, as I mentioned, the local lawyer down there, with the support of Lewis Pitts, a longtime civil rights lawyer from Greensboro. And what we alleged, among other things, was that it was a violation of his Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment rights. His Fourth Amendment right, that being Marcus Smith's Fourth Amendment right to be free from illegal searches and seizures, and his 14th Amendment right to due process of law for adequate medical care. And we also alleged under the Monell pattern and practice Supreme Court decision that it was the city was responsible for this through its police department for failing to train their officers adequately in the use of restraints. And in fact, there was something right on the wrapper of the restraint that said, do not hogtie. And in fact, there was a regulation within the police department that cautioned against hogtying people and specifically told them it could cause death by asphyxiation, and they did it anyway.
Who are the defendants, and what defenses are they raising?
Well, the defendants are the eight officers who were on the scene and surrounded Marcus, either put on the hogtie restraint or stood by while it happened, the two paramedics, the county paramedics, the city of Greensboro. The defenses that they're raising are the defenses that official municipalities always raise these days. It's qualified immunity. They claim first that there's no constitutional violation, that it didn't violate the Fourth Amendment, and then they say if it did violate the Fourth Amendment, then in fact they have immunity because they didn't know that it violated the Fourth Amendment or the 14th Amendment, and no specific law or decision of the courts informed them of that.
What is qualified immunity? Is qualified immunity an extra layer of protection that non-police citizens don't have and that the government grants to the police?
It's a court-created monster, to be very honest with you. It is an extra layer. Not only is it an extra layer, it's a layer that allows a pretrial appeal if they so want one. So it's under the guise that police officers and other officials need extra protection because they're performing important duties, and that we can't really courts and citizens can't really get in the way of that if there's any chance that the officers were acting in good faith or that they believed that what they were doing was okay to do. And what's happened in the last 30 or 40 years since the conservative Supreme Court basically created this doctrine, is that courts around the country, particularly conservative courts, have extended it, have made it more and more specific in the sense that the constitutional rights have to be more specifically articulated, and that constructive knowledge of the officers has to be much more demonstrated, or they get out of liability free card. And that's really what qualified immunity is with regard to police and other officials such as paramedics and others who have badges.
Is there a class or a racial aspect to the doctrine of qualified immunity?
Well, in effect, it certainly, as is everything else that we see in this day and age with regard to litigation and in terms of mass incarceration, you name it, yes, there's a racial aspect, a racist aspect to it, because more frequently it is our people of color, poor people who are being victimized by the police, who are being victimized by prison guards, who are being victimized by others in the line of duty. When they bring lawsuits, this qualified immunity is imposed against them. The prosecutors have absolute immunity for most all of their actions. So when they cover up evidence, for example, they have absolute immunity for that. So, yes, there are all these exceptions that impact more strongly against the poor and people of color when they are able to try to utilize the courts under the Civil Rights Act or other acts, but particularly the Civil Rights Acts.
Speaking about the judge's positive decision in this case, Marcus's sister, Kim Smith, stated that we want this to be a message for the world to know. People are sick of the injustices that take place involving the Greensboro police who kill and harass and brutalize innocent black citizens. What is the recent record of the Greensboro Police Department? I wanted to ask you that first before I ask you about the case that you were involved in back in 1979. But what's the recent record of the Greensboro Police Department?
Well, we should mention, Michael, that the judge, Judge Biggs, an African-American judge, woman judge, ruled in our favor recently on those questions of qualified immunity. With regard to both the police officers and with regard to the paramedics. And she also ruled in our favor with regard to a motion to dismiss filed by the Greensboro Police Department, and the officers ruled in our favor with regard to the city and found that the city had, in fact, failed to properly train their officers and that they could be held liable as well. So that was a major victory that Kim was she was responding to in her statement. With regard to your question about the Greensboro Police, their history goes back all the way to the 1960s, in North Carolina A&T uprising, where they shot and killed a student. It goes to the Greensboro Massacre in 1979 of the when the Klan and the Nazis paraded into Greensboro and the police were, their agents were involved as Klansmen, and the officers themselves turned their backs and went to the coffee shop while the Klansmen murdered five Klan, anti-Klan demonstrators and maimed others. And it goes to many more recent cases of discrimination within their police department, of brutality against African-American citizens. And so Greensboro has a rich and rich in a very negative way a history of police violence and misconduct and indifference to the constitutional rights of citizens.
What are the next steps that you attorneys are going to be taking in the Smith case?
Well, the next step is to do depositions. And, of course, that's going to be rather difficult to get going at this moment, but we want to question all of the officers involved. We want to question not only the officers, but the supervisors, those who trained or didn't train these officers or encouraged them to do the kinds of unconstitutional acts that led to the hog tying. And we want to question the mayor, the police chief, who has since resigned, claiming other reasons, but people feel that the strong movement that has arisen around this case and around police brutality in general in the Greensboro community had a major impact on that.
Attorney Flynn Taylor, you and the People's Law Office have had some 50 years of experience with police abuse in the city of Chicago. What must be done to stop police abuse? Is it woven into the racist class nature of our society?
Well, I think to ask that question may be to answer it, Michael. Yes, it obviously is woven into the fabric. And reforms are all well and good. And I think we as lawyers, progressive lawyers, radical lawyers, we fight for those reforms, but we also understand that the reforms by themselves are only going to be patchwork, they're only going to be Band-Aids, so to speak, and that, of course, we have to fight, we have to resist police violence, we have to resist racism in the courts and in the streets, but we also need to understand that there has to be fundamental change in the underlying society, in the priorities of government and of people in general, in terms of poverty, in terms of education, in terms of all medical care and all the kinds of things that lead to the inequities and the racist system of which the police and the prison guards and the mass incarceration is kind of the end game.
Attorney Flynn Taylor, how can people follow your work and that of your law firm, the People's Law Office?
Well, there's several ways. As you know, Mike, about a year ago, I came out with a book called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. That can be obtained, and you can learn much more about that. First, to deal with the murders of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the Black Panther leaders, and then, of course, the campaign to fight against police torture. You can certainly learn a great deal about our office on our website, peopleslawoffice.com.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. You keep safe.
You keep safe, and make sure that Law and Disorder stays on the air.
Thank you very much. You take it easy. So long, Flint.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.